And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Attention, people of Earth. Do not resist us. All who oppose us shall be annihilated. We command the most powerful army of monsters in the universe. They are sure to defeat your Earth monsters. All those who are hearing this are now under the control of the Earth Destruction Directive.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Earth Destruction Directive. I am your host, as always, Mr. Luke Giaconetti, and I would like to thank everyone for downloading and listening to the show today. Hope everyone had a chance to check out our previous episode where we took a look at the Game Boy Color game Godzilla, the series, Monster Wars. Fun little handheld game. We are changing directions this time out. We are jumping from the video game screen to the television screen, and we are actually taking a look at the final two episodes of the original Ultraman. This is an episode that's been a long time coming here on Earth Destruction Directive, and we are going to get into it, but we have several news items, so let's not dawdle and let's jump right into it. Godzilla X Kong: The New Empire has had a monstrous release. In its first weekend release, GXK grossed $80 million domestically, which was above the anticipated opening, which was estimated to be closer to the $50 to $60 million range. Now, that opening was good enough to be the second highest in the MonsterVerse franchise, trailing only the still admittedly crazy opening number of Godzilla 2014, which was $93 million. In the second weekend, the film retained the number one spot, took in an additional $31 million, bringing its overall domestic gross then to $134 million. That number was already higher than the total domestic gross of both Godzilla vs. Kong, which admittedly was released during COVID restrictions, as well as King of the Monsters, which is really telling. King of the Monsters was not a super successful film at the box office. In the third and fourth weeks, the film added another $24 million combined, bringing the domestic gross to $171 million, which passes Kong Skull Island's domestic number. Now, add to that the current international gross, as I'm recording this, of $315 million, and GXK has had an overall take of $488 million after four full weeks. That is well beyond King of the Monsters' overall total gross of $387 million, as well as Godzilla vs. Kong's number of $470 million. And now the film is chasing Godzilla 2014's $524 million, and the overall leader, Kong Skull Islands, in a worldwide gross of $568 million. Now, doing some back-of-the-envelope calculations of the opening weekend multipliers, my own personal estimate for Godzilla X Kong domestically is to hit somewhere between $190 and $230 million. That would be a heck of a draw for this film. The production budget has been rumored to be around $135 million, which sounds like a lot of money, and it is, but it's actually the lowest reported budget of any film in the MonsterVerse. So it's already looking like this has been a big hit for Legendary just on the money side of the equation. Now, director Adam Wingard has said that a third film for him, following on from Godzilla vs. Kong, Godzilla X Kong, would depend on the performance of this film. So it looks like we will be getting a third Godzilla and Kong installment in a few years' time, if you're asking me. In TV news, Monarch: Legacy of Monsters Season 2 has been announced as part of a deal with Apple TV Plus, which is described as part of a larger deal between the streaming service and Legendary. The announcement specifically states that there will be, quote, multiple spin-offs based on the franchise. Now, the quote from Morgan Wandel, who's the head of international development for Apple TV Plus, is, quote, "We couldn't be more excited for viewers to not only have the chance to experience even more thrills in Season 2, but to embark on epic new journeys in the franchise as we expand Legendary's MonsterVerse." Now, no timetable has been announced for the new season, nor any other additional content, although speculation right now is mid to late 2025 at the earliest. If nothing else, this will give me the kick in the pants I need to actually get Apple TV Plus and watch that first season, but that's neither here nor there. In Godzilla X Kong tie-in news, Hallmark is set to release a pair of Christmas ornaments of our titular monster stars. Monstars? Like Space Jam? Well, I mean, the OG Space Jam, not that LeBron James debacle. But anyway, two Christmas ornaments as part of their keepsake ornament collection for 2024. This is not terribly surprising to me, as Hallmark has released several Godzilla ornaments over the years, pretty much all of which I own, including one for Legendary Godzilla back in 2014. The ornaments are specifically of Supercharged Godzilla with his pink spines and Kong with his beast glove. No specific release information at this time, but more information as it becomes available. In crowdfunding news, the World of Nebulon Kickstarter is live, promising a new universe of tokusatsu-inspired heroes in a series of comics. The Kickstarter is for a preview book, which will, quote, introduce you and others to the wonderful world of tokusatsu. This is our first outing as we open the doors to our first tokusatsu universe, the Nebuverse. The campaign has a varied group of creators who are all extremely enthusiastic tokusatsu fans, and the preview features two 10-page stories and two 5-page previews of upcoming projects, plus extra behind-the-scenes material as well. I've had good luck backing tokusatsu and daikaiju-related comics projects on Kickstarter. This one looks intriguing at a low price point to jump in. There are PDF and print options available, as well as art prints and retailer options, so go on to Kickstarter and check that one out. In other crowdfunding news, Kevin Maguire's Tenga vs. the Kaiju of Kamara is live. Now, this campaign collects all 12 10-page Tonga strips, which Maguire did for DC Comics back in the early 2010s in the pages of the anthologies Weird Worlds and My Greatest Adventure. The series is described as such: join Tonga, an alien with massive powers on a cosmic scale, as she travels the universe looking for some simple creature comforts. Upon arriving on the planet Kamara, Tenga soon takes on the task of keeping the planet's inhabitants safe from the kaiju monsters that have begun to appear in frighteningly frequent numbers. She does all this while trying not to take the head off of Kamara's other protector, the egotistical Za. Now, folks, I legitimately loved this strip when it was part of those anthology titles, and I'm extremely excited to be back and available for consumption one again. It definitely slipped through the cracks at the time, along with one of its co-features, which was Aaron Lopresti's Garbage Man, which also got the crowdfunding collected edition a few years back. I have long tapped Tenga to be covered on the show. This is a great opportunity for those who missed it back in the day to check it out. So again, go into Kickstarter and take a look for that. I'll have even more crowdfunding news at the end of this episode, but for now, that's what I've got. So if you've got any news or other information that you think would be worthwhile here on the show, go ahead, send it in, earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com, and we'll give you credit here on the show. All right, I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the final two episodes, episodes 38 and 39 of Ultraman, right here on Earth Destruction Directive.
Hi, I'm Ruth.
And I'm Darren, of the Rad Adventures Network.
We're a married couple who enjoy great stories of all kinds, including adventures, mysteries, science fiction, and fantasy.
Please join us for a variety of podcasts focused on a range of pop culture topics.
Trekker Talk is about 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the comic Trekker by writer and artist Ron Randall. It's a blend of classic sci-fi adventures and noir mysteries set in a retro future.
Xenozoic Xenophiles is about the comic Xenozoic Tales by writer and artist Mark Schultz. It's a post-apocalyptic adventure series filled with Cadillacs and dinosaurs.
Warlord Worlds covers the many comics of writer and artist Mike Grell, including The Warlord, John Sable, Green Arrow, and the Legion of Superheroes.
Sensational Sleuths, where we talk about favorite mystery novels, movies, and TV shows.
Fantastic Fantasies, where we share our favorite fantasy films and books.
And Amazing Adventures, where we discuss action-packed adventure stories.
Listen on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Or visit radadventuresnetwork.com to find all of our shows and links to our social media pages.
That's RAD, R-A-D, which is short for Ruth and Darren.
All right, we are back here on Earth Destruction Directive. Ultraman, Episode 38, Spaced Rescue Command, subtitled featuring Saigo and Killa, originally aired on April 2nd, 1967 on Tokyo Broadcast System. Our writer is Shozo Uehara. Now, Uehara previously wrote The Lawless Monster Zone, which was Episode 8 of Ultraman back on Earth Destruction Directive number 32. Would go on to write several scripts for Ultra 7, as well as become the main writer for The Return of Ultraman. Uehara would leave Tsuburaya for Toei and actually become one of the most prolific writers for the studio, contributed to many different shows ranging from the Metal Hero series to the Super Sentai to Kamen Rider. Our director is Hajime Tsuburaya, the eldest son of Eiji Tsuburaya, who directed several episodes of this series, including the very first episode, which we covered way back on episode 17 of this show. He also directed The Lawless Monster Zone, written by Uehara, as well as a two-part The Prince of Monsters with Gomura, which we covered in episode 95. Now, Tsuburaya would tragically pass away very young, at age 41, from a sudden cerebral hemorrhage. So that's why there's not too many credits to his name. Our synopsis is adapted from ultra.fandom.com and goes a little something like this. NASA has launched an investigation of the mysterious planet Q, sending their advanced probe, codenamed Prospector, to the surface to transmit data back to Space Station V2. While observing the visuals, what looks to be a massive eye is caught by the camera. The eye flashes a blinding light, damaging the vision of all who can see it. A desperate call to the SSSP is placed, and the entire team blasts off in the spaceship Shiratori to rendezvous with the station. After navigating through a meteor shower, the patrol finds V2 like a ghost ship until they stumble upon the crew, all of whom have been temporarily blinded by the flash. To make matters worse, the station's BM fuse has been damaged, meaning that the station's power grid will overload and cause an explosion within 24 hours. Earth is too far away to get a replacement fuse sent in time, so Ide suggests they salvage a fuse from Prospector, which is closer. With a short window in which to accomplish their mission, the patrol leaves Fuji to watch over the station and departs for Planet Q. As the SSSP approaches Q, they witness a battle between two monsters, the Saurian quadruped Saigo and the armored monster Killa. The two monsters attack each other wildly, with Saigo blasting Killa with a breath weapon of sand particles, but Killa retaliating by flashing his eyes to blind his foe, causing Saigo to retreat. Landing, the patrol heads out in their SL-77 tracked space vehicle towards Prospector. The terrain is very difficult and made worse when they are accosted by Saigo. Hayata uses SL-77's missiles to blast Saigo to pieces, and the patrol continues on to Prospector. As Ide removes the relay from Prospector, Killa appears. Captain Muramatsu advises Arashi, armed with Ide's newest weapon, the Needle-type S-80, which is said to be 10 times as powerful as a spider shot, to not provoke the monster as they do not have time to deal with him. As Ide celebrates successfully removing the fuse, Kyla's interest is piqued, causing Arashi to open fire. Killa then flashes his eyes at Arashi, blinding him. Ide helps Arashi back to SL-77, and the patrol retreats. Their exfil is short-lived, though, as Killa blocks their path. Hayata volunteers to distract Killa while Ide and the captain head towards Shiratori to get the fuse back to V2 in time. Hayata changes to Ultraman and engages Killa. It seems like Ultraman has the upper hand, but Killa changes tactics and flashes his eyes at the hero, blinding him. Killa pushes the attack while Ultraman is dazed, but the hero eventually regains his sight, only to find that Killa shrugs off both the Ultra Cutter and the Specium Beam. Reaching deep into his arsenal, Ultraman lifts the monster using Ultra Psychokinesis and flings him away where Killa explodes. Meanwhile, Muramatsu and Ide find their progress slow on foot, and with the deadline looming, it does not look like they will make it. Muramatsu suggests using their compressed oxygen tanks like jetpacks, pushing the pair rapidly back to Shiratori. Muramatsu and Ide are able to blast off and return to V2 with 5 minutes to spare, and the narrator helpfully informs us that they return to pick up Hayata and Arashi once the station was safe. Back on V2, Arashi's eyes are treated, and the crew's vision is slowly getting better. Ide says he is looking forward to relaxing back on Earth, but the crew says that their space station is like an outer space vacation home. There's a lot crammed into this episode, so let's get right into the notes. And this episode was very much of the sci-fi adventure variety. There clearly was some money splashed around on the screen. We get lots of new technology and mecha, an outer space set for the action, and not one, but two different monsters. The flip side of this adventure-heavy episode is that what it has in action and effects, it lacks in character work and morality. But that has been demonstrated as one of the strengths of the series from the start. You can have a mix of what we might call monster or monsters of the week episodes along more complex installments, and both can work within the established format of the series. Front and center for me this episode is the newest mecha both for SSSP and evidently NASA to use. Space Station V2 is a wonderfully late 60s style space station. It evokes a traditional wheel and spokes motif common to space stations, but instead of cylindrical sections similar to, say, the Gamma 3 from the Green Slime, we get slab-sized with a rigid texture. It almost looks to be a mix between a space station and a satellite, and the end result is very aesthetically pleasing. The size of the station seems a little off, however. The size difference between Shiratori and V2 when the shuttle docks suggests that V2 is very cramped inside, or perhaps Shiratori has a lot of non-cabin space available. Speaking of which, Shiratori is a nice and trim space shuttle. Reminds me, for all the world, like the little drone jet which was mounted on top of the Cobra Night Raven from G.I. Joe, but I digress. The shuttle is also quite clearly an extension of the standard jet VTOL hull, which I like as it gives a level of continuity to the SSSP's fleet. The most standout new piece of mecha, though, is the SL-77 surface vehicle. With an oblong cabin mounted on tall legs above a pair of treads, it looks suitably rugged to take on any alien surface. The retractable missile rack is a nice touch, too. The entire thing is extremely toyetic and very much embracing the mid to late 60s sci-fi design style in its execution. The closest comparison I could come up with is the Chariot from Lost in Space, but lifted and given a suspension kit to tackle rough terrain. In the interest of fairness, I will state that Lost in Space does predate Ultraman, but that said, I think the SL-77 could take it in either a race or a fight, just saying. All these new machines debuting in the second-to-last episode of the series really tickled me, as it showed that the Tsuburaya team was still turning out new and different ideas even at this late stage of the series, not just writing out the last few episodes and moving on. The focus on effects continues even as the story advances. The SSSP flies through a meteor shower on their way to V2. While a nifty, if very short, action sequence, other than to provide peril and another special effect, the meteor shower does not serve any real narrative purpose. It is part of the entire theme of the episode, though, which is the various perils and dangers the SSP must overcome to save the space station. The extremely creepy setup when they land on the ghost ship V2 is a nice touch as well, adding a little horror fake-out, and also, once more, ramping up the element of danger inherent in any mission in outer space. I will also personally admit to getting Disney's The Black Hole vibes here, landing on a ghost ship, although in the film, the meteor shower comes after they land, not before. We get some smaller tech as well. Prospector is a simple but elegant probe, a tripod with a small capsule at its apex. And of course, Ide has a new gun for Arashi. The S-80 is a wonderful heavy weapon, firing off a series of rockets in rapid-fire succession. Now, it does not do much against Kyla, but a cool weapon nonetheless. Appropriately for an episode so heavy with effects, we get some very strong effects shot compositions this time out. The aforementioned meteor shower, with a few dozen small meteors all suspended by wires, with Shiratori moving through them, might be low-tech, but it is effective. Later, we see Shiratori dock with V2 and then disembark, and I am always a sucker for that sort of effect. Moving the two models together has the potential to be very clunky, but here it is smooth and unruffled. The best shot in the entire episode comes on the surface of Planet Q. As the SSSP retreats in the SL-77, we see Prospector in the foreground, and looming behind an outcropping of rocks is Kyla. All three of the elements look natural, and none of them are out of place or obviously composited into the shot. It's a great shot, and even though it only lasts for a few seconds, it definitely stood out to me. Kyle is our main monster this time out, and he's hard to classify. His head makes him look like an insect, but his body more resembles that of a reptile, sort of like Telesodon. He's certainly very tough, being able to resist multiple attacks from Ultraman. But a couple of oddities. First off, Kyla has a blinding flash attack, which we literally just saw two episodes prior with the monster Zarangus in episode 36, Don't Shoot Arashi, which we covered on episode 124. We have had some 40-odd monsters in this series, and the two that flash their eyes to blind their enemies appear within a couple of weeks of each other. The other note about Kylo's appearance here is the sound effect which is used when he flashes his eyes. You'll likely recognize it from the opening credits. That sound, used in the opening of every episode, has its origin in Ultra Q as the cracking door sound. Why this sound was chosen, I do not know, but it's certainly memorable used in this context. Our other monster, Saigo, has an interesting origin. He originally was going to be the last monster faced by Ultraman. His name translates to final or last, and the story goes that he was going to be the monster who defeated Ultraman, with Zetton, more on him later, as the preliminary threat. And supposedly, the design for Saigo was deemed less visually interesting, and he was demoted to his role in this episode. Now, Saigo's design is vaguely Saurian, but his body shape suggests earlier monsters such as Gamma Kujira and especially Gubaila. As we do not get to see him battle Ultraman, and in both scenes he ends up losing, it's hard to really see Saigo as being a strong enough monster to be a legitimate threat. He's just not as novel or visual as Kyla in this episode. In addition to their appearance here, Kyla would return in Ultra Fight for various episodes and would be one of the monsters making up the giant monster body of Ballidora in Mega Monster Battle Ultra Galaxy Legends, the movie. Kyla would appear alongside Gaira from War of the Gargantuas in a little-known series called He of the Sun, which from what I can tell is a drama series, and at least this episode focuses on a suit actor, played by Haru Nakajima, who is actually credited with Kyla in this episode as well. Continuing that trend, both Kyla and Saigo did reappear together in a different Japanese drama series named Naite Tamaruka, an episode 76 entitled Oh, Kaiju, Japan's Number One Actor. I have tried to find additional information on this series with no luck, but I'm guessing it takes place at a studio where they are filming the monsters for a sci-fi series, just based on the title, but all of that is speculation on my part. One moment in the script intrigued me. The captain asking Hayata what he would do when they were in a tough spot down on Planet Q. Normally, the captain is unflappable and has a plan to deal with whatever is thrown at them. He does exactly that later in the episode with the compressed air tanks. So thus begins my speculation. Does Muramatsu suspect Hayata is Ultraman? It just seems out of character for the captain to ask Hayata his opinion in this situation, unless he suspects that he needs to break them up for Hayata to change to Ultraman. You could also read this scene as Muramatsu just sort of being out of options, given the number of hurdles they have already overcome at this point. I don't know if I'm overthinking this, as Daikaiju fans have been known to do on occasion, but I still think it stood out, especially as we are getting on towards the end of the series. My good friend and loyal listener, Professor Allen, from the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, sent in some pre-feedback for the episode, and here's what the professor thought about Spaceship Rescue Command. Luke, glad to hear that you are covering the last two episodes of the original Ultraman, and I hope this pre-feedback arrives before you record on those episodes. If not, please consider this good old-fashioned post-feedback. Well, Professor, you made it, so pre-feedback it is. Episode 38, Spaceship Rescue Order, has an interesting bit of timing behind it. Synchronicity, one might say. Oh boy. The inciting incident of the episode was a bright flash of light that caused blindness. I watched this the evening of the recent solar eclipse, which also had the potential for eye damage. Just to be safe, I did not look directly at the screen during the episode, probably for the best. Probably for the best. Better safe than sorry, right? The setting was a nice change of pace, and the monster's method of attack was different than most. I enjoyed the scenes inside the shuttle and on the planet's surface. Even the model work wasn't bad. I don't recall seeing that swirly use of Ultraman's power before, but I liked it, and it sure came in handy. Enjoyable episode. Thank you very much, Professor. Yeah, that Ultra Psychokinesis doesn't appear anywhere else in this series. So, the power for every plot twist, right? Like Captain Everything back in the day from Normal Man. But, we'll take it. I mean, Ultraman's powers have always been fairly broadly defined, right? So thank you again for that feedback, Professor. Now, if you would like to watch Spaceship Rescue Command, you have a couple of options. You can pick up the original series on Blu-ray from Mill Creek, which I do believe still includes that Movie Spree digital copies for whatever those are worth. In addition, the episode can be streamed for free with ads on Shout Factory TV. So I throw it to you, the listener. What do you think? Do you like this episode? Do you think it's neat to have two monsters? Why do we have two monsters that can flash their eyes and blind people so quickly? Are so close back to back. Write in and we'll talk about it. EarthDestructionDirective@yahoo.com. All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back with our second and final episode of the original Ultraman right here on Earth Destruction Directive.
This is an imaginary podcast, which may never have happened.
The Short Box Showcase.
But then again, may have. About a father and daughter. I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily.
Who came from Ohio and talked about comics.
Walking Dead.
Tintin.
Black Lightning.
White Tiger. It tells of their rise to glory, when the great guests were yet to be booked.
Let's put it this way, Shogun Warriors wasn't going to win any Eisners.
And the great feats of editing not yet performed.
This is Ultra 7, this is Ultraman Jack, and this is Ultraman Taro, and this is Ultraman Leo, and this
of how they spoke at length.
This continuity is really the brainchild of nitpicking nerds the world over.
But to be fair, the best kind of confession is the Force confession.
And reviewed in brief tales that explore creatively the bounds of a given character's history.
Red Sun is wonderful with a very strange ending.
Of brilliant creators before their fall from grace. This is the era where Miller is at the height of his creative and artistic powers. And the ability of strong writing to encapsulate and transcend its time.
Flash of Two Earths by Gardner Fox.
This is an imaginary podcast. Aren't they all? Shortbox Showcase is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Check us out on the web at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search in iTunes for Relatively Geeky or Shortbox Showcase. And remember, we're not experts.
We're just family.
All right, we are back here on Earth Destruction Directive. Ultraman, Episode 39, Farewell Ultraman, subtitled featuring Space Dinosaur Zetton, originally aired April 9th, 1967, on Tokyo Broadcast System. Our writer is Tetsuo Kinjo, and I cannot say I am surprised that Kinjo is handling the final episode. Kinjo, of course, was one of the earliest and most crucial creators of the Ultra series, one of the creators of Ultra Q, head writer of both Ultraman and Ultra 7, so it is fitting that he would handle the finale as well as he had handled the debut episode, 38 episodes prior. Our director is Hajime Tsuburaya, whom we discussed earlier on in this episode. And our synopsis goes a little something like this. On what seems to be a normal day for the Earth, a massive invasion fleet of alien ships is spotted by satellites. SSSP HQ in Paris coordinates with all the HQs around the globe to be on high alert and determines that the fleet will enter the atmosphere within the hour. As the fleet destroys Earth satellites in its approach, Ide and Arashi are impatient, telling the captain they feel they should counterattack immediately. But the captain reminds them that in matters of global security, Paris HQ gives the orders, and they are obligated to obey. The allotted time of arrival comes, and the invasion fleet is massing towards Japan. Paris HQ speculates that this is being done to eliminate the Japan HQ and Ultraman, as they have thwarted other invasions previously. Paris informs the SSSP that the battle will be their own to defend the Earth. JASDF forces are scrambled to engage the UFOs, and a massive aerial battle ensues. Both sides suffer losses, but eventually the UFOs beat back the JASDF and continue onward. The SSSP scrambles their jet VTOLs, leaving Fuji as liaison at HQ, along with the consulting Professor Iwamoto. The SSSP is very successful against the UFOs, eliminating the remaining smaller saucers. but are unable to stop the larger mothership, which hides in the mountains to avoid detection. Back at HQ, the professor is attacked by an unseen assailant while trying to give his new weapon prototype to the SSSP. The professor then returns to the control room and assaults Fuji, leaving her prone on the floor, then destroys the communications and control board, starting a fire. The other SSSP members return in time to find Fuji before she is overcome by smoke inhalation and give chase to the fleeing Iwamoto. After being tackled, Iwamoto reveals himself to be a member of an alien race who is impersonating the professor. The alien is quickly eliminated by Hayata with the Mars 133 gun, who intones Zeton as he fades away. The mothership is then revealed, releasing a strange black bubble, forming a towering monster, who echoes the intonation of Zeton. The monster immediately sets forth to destroy the SSSPHQ. Right then, the real Professor Iwamoto radios the team as he is trapped inside. Captain Muramatsu sends Arashi and Hayata to find the professor while he holds off Zeton with the Mars 133. Hayata lags behind Arashi and changes to Ultraman, who then uses his catch rings technique to stop Zeton in his tracks. The two battle back and forth furiously, as it seems Zeton has a counter for each of Ultraman's attacks, including a barrier which shatters the Ultra Slash harmlessly. Tackling Ultraman to the ground, Zeton pounds on his foe and tries to choke the life out of him. Ultraman refuses to give up and battles back, blasting Zeton with the Specium Beam. But the monster absorbs the beam and returns it right back at Ultraman. The attack is too much for our hero, and Ultraman collapses to the ground, defeated. The SSSP is stunned and scream their support for the Defender of Earth. Professor Iwamoto gives Arashi the weapon he had tried to give the SSSP earlier, a prototype rocket fired from their sidearm. Arashi aims and fires true, detonating Zeton and ending the threat. After extinguishing the fire at HQ with a deluge system, the SSSP are surprised by the appearance in the sky of a second Ultraman. The new Ultra spins himself into a red sphere and then absorbs the fallen hero into it. In the Ultra dimension, the new arrival, Zaffi, tells Ultraman that it is time to return to the Land of Light. Ultraman says that his life is not his own, and that if he leaves, an Earthling will die. When Zaffi says that Ultraman has fought enough for the Earth and would be forgiven, Ultraman replies that he will not sacrifice Hayata. Ultraman says he would give his life to Hayata, as it does not matter if he dies, for he has lived for 20,000 years. Zaffi sees the deep love Ultraman has for humanity and tells his charge that he has brought two lives with him, one for Hayata and one for Ultraman. Zaffi separates Ultraman and Hayata, and the two Ultras leave in the Red Sphere. This leaves Hayata, who comments on the Red Sphere he crashed into all those months ago, as he has no memories of his time with Ultraman. The SSSP bid their farewells as they reaffirm their duty to protect peace on Earth. In space, as the narrator tells us that Ultraman will pray for peace on Earth, the two Ultras fly back to the Land of Light. The end. Well, we all knew that the end was coming, and it was a doozy, so let's get right into the notes. Our finale is an action-packed episode, and I don't have any issue with that. Ultraman is a science fiction action show first and foremost, so leaning in on that on the blow-off episode is welcome. We got a fleet of UFOs invading Earth, the SSSP battling them ship to ship, an alien infiltrating their HQ and setting it ablaze, Ultraman battling a seemingly invincible enemy, a second Ultra hero. There's lots here, and it certainly has the requisite gravitas of a series finale. The size and scale of the invasion fleet, and the SSSP Paris statement that, oh yeah, they're all coming to you, Japan, so good luck, makes it seem like it could be the time they don't overcome the odds. Intellectually, we know that Ultraman and the SSSP won't fail, but it certainly seems like everything is stacked against them. The fleet of UFOs is the most ambitious fleet of enemy ships we have seen in the series. It strikes me as a more cinematic approach to an invasion than we had seen previously, those being more devious or underhanded invasions rather than brute force. Thematically, I was reminded of other tokusatsu works such as The Mysterians, which we cover in episode 37, or Monster Zero, which we covered in episode 55, or even Battle in Outer Space, which I covered with Nathan Marchand and Jimmy from NASA on the Monster Island Film Vault episode 15. The fact that Tsuburaya uses the classic UFO sound effect from Monster Zero helps with this connection. Such a great sound effect. I love that one so much. The ships themselves are nicely designed and move well, and I like the symmetry of the smaller ships and their larger mothership. The wires are pretty apparent when they explode, the flash of light making them pretty plain, but hey, it's a TV budget, you do what you can, right? Especially with this many ships. The Zetton alien, who is actually unnamed in this episode and would not get a species name until Ultraman Max in the Heisei era. It's an interesting reuse of actually the Kemmer alien suit from Ultra Q. Now, I say interesting because the Tsuburaya team did not actually do any work on the head. They simply turned it 90 degrees. The difference is further played up by having alien Zetton disguise himself as Professor Iwamoto, meaning that he's wearing human clothes when his identity is revealed. Thus, we don't get the full Kemmer alien suit. Well, very much overshadowed by Zetton proper, alien Zetton does get some effective moments in this episode. The most noteworthy to me is his throttling of Fuji and leaving her to die after he destroys the control room. Direct physical violence against a female character is always shocking, but coming here in 1967 definitely takes the viewer back. And just to close the loop, alien Zetton would eventually get his own suit in the Heisei era, despite his origins as Kamor Seijin facing to the right. Now, of course, the biggest attraction here is the biggest bad of them all, Zetton. As I mentioned earlier regarding Saigo, Zetton very much looks the role of the final monster. He's toweringly tall, coupled with his ominous black and silver coloring and his lack of a discernible face. It makes him an ominous and imposing enemy. Naturally, his extensive arsenal helps in this matter, too. Now, similar to Saigo, Zetton's name is a play on words. The first part of his name, Zetto, is the Japanese pronunciation of the letter Z, which is parsed as Z in some parts of the world, such as the UK. That portion about Zetto coming for Z, I've heard that for many years in many different explanations and in different books. What I learned in my research for this episode is that the second portion, the N sound, is also a play on words. In Japanese, all words end with a vowel sound or with an N sound. An N cannot begin a word, so it has the connotation of being end or final in Japanese. Combine this with the linking word to, meaning and in Japanese, and you get Zetto to N, the last and final monster, Zetton. In the interest of curiosity, I ran this whole linguistic exercise by my good friend Casey of the 8TW Theater Group, who is my go-to for all Japanese language questions, and she told me that this was reasonable, so I'm going to run with it. Given all this, it's not surprising that Zetton has become a fan favorite monster since his initial appearance here, reappearing as soon as Return of Ultraman and numerous times since. He would also take on numerous forms over the years, including that of Hyper Zetton, as seen in the film Ultraman Saga, which we covered back on episode 112. My favorite Zetton moment after this episode, however, is in the web series Ultra Galaxy Fight the Absolute Conspiracy, where Fear Demon Zet creates an artificial Zetton army to battle in service of the Kingdom, leading to one of my favorite lines ever in an Ultra series, where Ultraman Zet says to Fear Demon Zet, "You've got a confusing name that sounds just like mine! I am Zet! Ultraman Zet!" As Ultraman lays defeated, we do get a couple of flashbacks, namely Jiris and Gabora, who, oddly enough, are from back-to-back episodes, numbers 9 and 10, which we covered on episode 38. It is admittedly a cliche to have a monster or hero battle all the other monsters, and then a new one show up with some special powers to win on the last page of your story, but in this case, I'm on board with it here in this context. The story establishes that the Zetton fleet is targeting Japan specifically to eliminate the threat which has stopped several previous invasions, namely the SSSP and Ultraman. To that end, it's a reasonable step to think that they would breed or otherwise create their weapon, which would be designed specifically to defeat Ultraman. The fact that Zetton succeeds in defeating Ultraman, only to fall to the ingenuity and bravery of humanity, speaks volumes not only to the central theme of this show and the subsequent Ultra series, but to Japanese pop culture in general for the era. Similarly, my favorite line from the episode comes from Zaffi when he tells Ultraman that peace on Earth only has value if the humans grasp it for themselves. In a single line of dialogue, Kinjo succinctly summarizes the thematic through line of the series. Yes, Ultraman is the shining beacon of light who serves as the example for all of humanity to strive towards. But without that effort, the drive, the willingness to act yourself to do the right thing for your fellow Earthlings, that doesn't matter. This central theme is one of the most attractive elements of the Ultra series to me. Yes, there are plenty of monster fights, but I'm strongly pulled to the statement that we have the power to make the world better for everyone if we are brave enough to stand up and do what's right. Perhaps that's a naive sentiment these days, but hey, who am I to judge? One notable difference between the original Japanese airing and the dubbed English version of this episode involves Hayata's final fate. In the Japanese, as we covered in the synopsis, Hayata has no memory of his time merged with Ultraman, referring directly to his crash with the Red Sphere back in Episode 1, which of course we covered in Episode 17 of the show. The English dub changes this so that Hayata remembers his time as Ultraman, saying that he knows he will return, and specifically that the chief, who is the unnamed Zaffi, told him, Hayata, that Ultraman would return. The narrator then tells us that Hayata held fast to his beta capsule, knowing that Ultraman would return someday. Of course, Ultraman would in fact return, as would Hayata, some 4.5 years later in Return of Ultraman, appearing alongside Dan Moriboshi, better known as Ultra 7, in episode 38 of that series. Strangely enough, how Hayata and Ultraman re-merged is a story which has actually never been revealed, despite the numerous times Hayata and Ultraman have shown up over the course of the Ultra series. I am of two minds about this ending. On the one hand, I do think it is a fitting final note for Hayata not to remember his time with Ultraman, as it puts a period at the end of the series. I don't like that it suggests that Hayata's personality as seen in the series is not his own, but in fact Ultraman's. And as part of the overall Ultra series, I prefer Hayata remembering his friend and partner. This sliding scale of how much the human and Ultra are partners versus alter egos varies throughout the course of the Ultra series, so there's no hard and fast rule here. So in my headcanon, pardon my editorial laugh, ha ha, I choose to think that Hayata temporarily lost his memories of Ultraman due to the physical trauma he suffered in the battle against Zetton, but they did eventually return. And when Earth was in danger again, Ultraman returned and re-merged with his old partner to defend the planet. Being the last episode of the series, there are some classic finale trappings on display here. The defeat of the hero, including the off-reference color timer going out completely, is the obvious one. But we also get the HQ being directly attacked, both with alien Zetton sabotage and the fire, as well as Zetton physically damaging the building. Both the massive invasion fleet leading to a major aerial battle, as well as the big bad monster who can resist everything the hero throws at him, dip into the TB Fate trope, aka the big fight at the end, where all rules are off. I think sometimes we fans like to think of these touches as being more modern, but here we are, hip deep in the Showa era, and it's all right there on the screen. Now, of course, our good friend Professor Allen had some pre-feedback thoughts on this episode as well, and here's what Allen had to say. And the finale, Farewell Ultraman. First, be careful with the spoilers in the episode titles, guys. Yeah, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword, Professor, right? I mean, one could say spoilers, but the other side could say, does what it says on the tin, right? Professor continues, second, the Science Patrol really gets their image enhanced in this one. The last resort to avoid disaster. Wow, if the organization is really that important, maybe Ide should take his job more seriously. But I digress. This one had some nice production elements. The flying saucers looked good, and the music that accompanied them was appropriately foreboding. The close-up on the hands of the clock was a nice touch. The stakes are often high in sci-fi shows like this, and Ultraman has had other high-stakes episodes, but the somber tone in this one makes the stakes feel more serious, more somber. And come on, the episode even had an alien in a business suit. I love aliens in business suits. Spoken like a man of finance right there, right? And then the ending, memorable. As in, I'm pretty sure I remember this scene from when I was a kid. There are some striking visuals in this sequence. Thanks for covering the show. I've enjoyed hearing you discuss the episodes and appreciate the opportunity it afforded me for a rewatch. Keep 'em stomping, buddy. Signed, Professor Allen. Well, Allen, thank you very much for all your pre-feedback. It's really helped get different perspectives on these episodes, especially with you coming in from watching them as a kid and me having come in watching them when I was a bit older. So I really have appreciated this, and hopefully we can keep that going with more Ultra content in the future. But thank you very much. So if you would like to watch Farewell Ultraman again, you can check it out on Blu-ray from Mill Creek, or it can be streamed at Shout Factory TV, and it is included on the Movie Spree, streaming service if you have that Blu-ray or bought it digitally before that storefront was determined by Mill Creek to be no longer profitable. So now we have come to the end of the line for the original Ultraman. We started coverage of this series in November of 2012. Yes, kind listeners, it has taken me more than a decade to cover all 39 episodes of Ultraman. A lot has changed for me, for the show, for the world, and yes, even for the Ultra series in that time frame. But some things have stayed the same. The Ultra series is still being produced today, and in fact, is more popular and prevalent now than it was in 2012. Looking back, several episodes of this series stand out as personal favorites. The first episode with Bemular, of course, my favorite Ultra Kaiju. Cry of the Mummy, mixing a universal horror with a Daikaiju epic. The Monster Prince with Gomura, the closest we got to an Ultraman feature at this time period. Demons Rise Again with Aboris and Vanilla beating the heck out of each other for most of the episode. Overthrow the Surface, dripping with paranoia and the classic sci-fi trope of an invasive subterranean race. And of course, My Home is Earth with Jamila. One of the best single episodes of any science fiction TV series, bar none. It is hard to overstate just how influential this series was, not only to the rest of the Ultra series, but on the tokusatsu medium and the Daikaiju and Kyodai hero genres at large. Without Ultraman, would we get Kamen Rider or the Super Sentai in addition to the loss of the Ultra series? Without Ultraman as the base case of a Kyodai hero, do we get Super Robot manga like Mazinger Z or anime shows like Brave Raiden? Without that, do we get the importation to the West of the Shogun Warrior toys and eventually anime localizations such as Voltron or Robotech? Without super robots, can real robot properties like Gundam even exist? Or even more fantastical ideas like Evangelion or Pacific Rim? Does Daikaiju even survive the 1970s to return in the 1980s without Ultraman? Beyond the sheer level of influence of the series, the fact of the matter is that despite being made nearly 50 years ago, the show remains exciting, fun, adventurous viewing. Characters are likable, the monsters creative and memorable, the mecha timeless. No, every episode is not a classic. The classic episodes remain as appealing now as they were when they first aired. Monsters and aliens such as Gomura, Baltan, Red King, Pigmon, Mephiles, and yes, even Zetton, are still beloved by fans young and old. But more importantly, the tenets of justice, duty, service, and loyalty remain at the forefront of the series, and it is these elements which, to me, make the original Ultraman such an integral part of the Daikaiju scene to this day. Yes, other shows in the series and other heroes may be more popular, have better special effects, or innovative storylines, or big flashy feature-length movies, but for me it all starts here and it all comes back to the original, and I am proud to have covered the series from start to finish here on the podcast. So now I throw it to you, the listeners. What are your thoughts on these final two episodes of Ultraman? But also, what are your thoughts on the series in general? Have you followed along with us like Professor Allen? Do you want to check the show out now? Or did it not work as well for you? Write to me, earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. Reach out to me on Facebook or Twitter/X or YouTube, and we can talk about it here on the show. All right, that's all I've got right now, folks. We're going to take a quick break, come back, do a little bit of listener feedback, and close out the show right here on Earth Destruction Directive.
Once upon a time, five friends who met on the Bot Talk Transformers forum set out to develop a podcast dedicated to their various interests: Transformers, science fiction, fantasy, and comic books. Part fanboys and part assholes, they came to be known as the Fanholes. Their unbridled enthusiasm for podcasting did not end there, and soon enough, their proper podcast spun off into the Fanholes network of podcasts. Besides our podcast proper, the Fanhole soon had a continuum of genre-specific, focused shows such as Mobile Suit Mondays, Transformers Tuesdays, Toku Thursdays, and Sentai Saturdays. New weekly content can be found on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fanholespodcast.blogspot.com. Fanholes Podcast, the pop culture podcast, made for the fans, by the fans.
All right, we are back here on Nerd Destruction Directive, and I hold in my hands a little bit of listener feedback. If you would like to get in touch with the show, you can email me at nerddestructiondirective@yahoo.com. You can also reach me on Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. Just listen to the outro to the show, and we'll have all that information for you there. So our email today comes from my brother Jason Giaconetti, and the subject is Godzilla and Godzilla Raids Again book. Hey Luke, just a quick note this time out. I'm about halfway through the Shigeru Kiyama novella Godzilla, and so far it has been a fun read. It is different than the 1954 film, but yet still has a very similar feeling to it. The writing style is different than you see with most Western authors, but nothing that would stop anyone from enjoying the book. Hoping to finish it up and get to Godzilla Raids again soon. Keep them stomping. Jay, first off, thank you very much for writing in. Definitely appreciate that. And again with the synchronicity, because as I'm recording this, I just started reading the Kiyama novelizations like 2 days ago. So I'm about a third of the way through Godzilla right now. And obviously I haven't gotten to Godzilla Raids again. And I agree with you. It definitely does have the way that the prose is written. You can, I think, tell that this was written in Japanese and then translated to English, just kind of the way that the phrasing and the pacing is. It's easy to read. It's not like it's a challenge, but it is a little bit different than a way a Western author might assemble a novelization, right? But yes, I very much like that. I have seen a lot of people excited about those two novelizations, both inside the fandom and outside. I think inside the fandom, the idea of getting those Japanese novellas in English for the first time got a lot of people excited. And I think on the casual or outside the fandom, right, I think just seeing a book like that just piqued a lot of people's interest. I know I've had questions over the years, like, is there a, you know, for lack of a better term, a Daikaiju or a Godzilla expanded universe, right? Like we see with like Star Trek or Star Wars or Doctor Who or other science fiction properties. And there's really not for Godzilla. There's a few other works here and there. And of course, there's the comics, but there's not like a series of prose novels, right? So I think getting a series of prose novels like this that were not like the YA books from the 2000s, I think has a lot of people just very interested and intrigued. And I'm enjoying it. So I appreciate you writing in. And again, who can't be topical, right? I mean, I started reading it, and right now we're covering your email. So thank you very much, Jay. Very much appreciate the email on that. And I hope you enjoyed the rest of the book. I'm enjoying it so far. You know, I'm a fairly slow reader right now. You know, I love my wife who just grinds through books. I mean, she can read so fast and her memory is so good. I don't have that kind of throughput. So, but any event, thank you very much for the email. Social media support for the last couple episodes came from, hey, there it is, my aforementioned brother, Jason Giaconetti, along with John Vanover, Adam Tebow, Bob Hansen at the Bob Squad, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Mr. Lomax, Derek WC, the Fan Holes, the History of Comics on Film, Chris Mounts, Billy D from Magazines and Monsters, Gene, the podcasting machine Hendrix from Two True Freaks, Brian Sever, Bro Rad, Matthew Mastro Giovanni, Chuck Rodriguez, Tim Elliott, Dale Freeman, Cameron Jackson, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, the Two True Freaks Podcast Network, The Telltale Mind, Nathan Marchand and the Monster Island Film Vault, Crystal Lady Jessica, The Power Trip Podcast, The Henshin Men Podcast, and Bill at Spy Vinyl. Thank you very much, everyone, for the social media support. I say it all the time, and it's still true. A podcast like this is a labor of love. We do this because of our enjoyment and our love for the material. So anytime that you can signal boost, you know, get the word out about a show that you like, it really means a lot to me, and I know it means a lot to my fellow podcast creators just to see that engagement and that you're given that vote of confidence that, hey, I like what you're doing and I want to get other people out there to enjoy it. So it's very much appreciated, and I really do mean that. And I do also want to take this time to say that Earth Destruction Directive is for everyone, and we are not, as we've talked about this many times before, we're not a gatekeeping show. We're a show for the people. right? If you have any interest in giant monsters, maybe you got caught up in all the hype around Minus One. And who didn't get caught up in hype around Minus One? Or maybe you were just super, super pumped to go see Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire, and you went and saw that and you had a blast, and now you're dipping your toe into learning more about giant monsters. You are welcome to interact with this show at any level that you feel comfortable. If you want to reach out, if you want to just listen, you want to reach out on Discord, any of that, you know, all are welcome at Earth Destruction Directive. And so now we come, now that we have an ending, with the ending of Ultraman, we must have a new beginning. What is our new topic going to be on our next episode? We're going to be jumping back into the printed page. We're going to be taking a look at another comic series. We're taking a look at the Kickstarter book, Kaiju and Cowboys, issue 1 and 2, created by Matthew Blair. Now, this is maybe not one that that you've heard about. I know I've mentioned these Kickstarter campaigns before. The reason why I wanted to do issues 1 and 2 now is that as I am recording this, and I'm going to put the link in the show notes and on social media, the Kickstarter campaign for issue number 4 is live right now. Like right now as I'm recording this, okay? So I want to talk about 1 and 2 and get that out as soon as I can during this Kickstarter campaign, because I really enjoy this offbeat title, Kaiju and Cowboys, and I really want to get it out there because I don't know that this one's gotten as much play as some of the other Daikaiju related Kickstarter comics campaigns that I've come across. So this is what I was saying earlier when I said I had more crowdfunding news. It's a really, really fun series. It's very different than I think you might think from the title. I'm going to read you the little one-hitter synopsis, and you'll get an idea of where we're going. So the one-liner for Kaiju and Cowboys is, on an alien planet, a lone cowboy robot known only as the Hunter confronts a herd of kaiju monsters that threaten his fellow robots. So it's not just monsters and cowboys, they're robot cowboys. And giddy up is all I got to say. So definitely check that out. Like I said, I'll put the link to the Kickstarter in the show notes and on social media. So please go check out that Kickstarter campaign and take a look at Kaiju and Cowboys. So that is all I've got for this episode. I want to thank everyone for taking the time to download and listen to it. Hope you enjoyed our coverage of the last two episodes of the original Ultraman. Hope you'll come back for issues 1 and 2 of Kaiju and Cowboys. And hope you check out that Kickstarter campaign as well. And until next time, keep them stomping.
This has been Earth Destruction Directive, a Daikaiju podcast, produced and created by me, Luke Giaconetti, as part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, available at twotruefreaks.com. This is a fan work celebrating the history and culture of Japanese giant monsters. All movies, TV shows, comic books, characters, and other intellectual property is copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended or implied. If you would like to send an email to the show, you can email me at earthdestructiondirective@yahoo.com. I try to respond to all emails, and if you send in some comments, I will read them on the show. All episodes of Earth Destruction Directive can be found at twotruefreaks.com. You can also find the show on your favorite podcatcher. Just search for Earth Destruction Directive. You can even leave a review on your podcatcher of choice if you'd like. You can find me on Facebook. Just search for first name Luke, last name EDD. You can also get in touch with me on Twitter. Just search for the handle at LJacone. That's LJACONE. The theme song for this podcast is Future Gladiator by Kevin MacLeod, downloaded from incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0 license. Thanks for listening, and be sure to come back next time for more city-stomping fun here on Earth Destruction Directive. Tune in next time to hear the crusty old podcaster from Oklahoma say,
there's a WTF moment if I ever saw one.